Our God is the God of the upside down, isn't he? Our God is the God of the back, the front. The Bible states that my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, and so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts. Jesus said, if any one of you wants to be great, he must be the slave of all. The first shall be last and the last shall be first. It's upside down to the way the world works. He told the host of the banquet to offer the best seats to the poor and the lowly of this world. He taught us to love our enemies and pray for those who persecute us. He said, unless a seed falls to the ground and dies, it will not give birth to anything new. If you want to find life, you must lose it for his sake. If you want to follow Christ, you must deny yourself. When Jesus walked among the earth 2,000 years ago, it was the elite who held the positions of power. It was the educated who ruled over the ignorant. It was the learned who sat in the synagogues and the temples. It was the strong who muscled their way into leadership. It was the best of the best, the cream of the crop, as it were, the privileged, the influential, the select few, the chosen ones who had all the control, who had the supremacy. They all had the clout. Everyone knew who was calling the shots and who commanded the masses. It was the Pharisees and it was the Sadducees, members of another ancient Jewish group of priests and aristocrats, who were among the top of the tree, society's elite. They were the ones who were invited to all the parties. They were the celebrities of today's world. Even amid Roman occupation, they held great sway and influence, power and domination, domination over the crowds. And in walks Jesus of Nazareth. He lived among the common peoples of the day. He calls the tax collectors and the despised and the rejected. He recruits fishermen and he appoints the sons of thunder as apostles and sends them out to begin a revolution, not an uprising. He speaks and he lives and he acts and he teaches as somebody with authority, not with power. And there's a distinction. Jesus held no positions of power. He had no degrees or qualifications. He was no earthly king or prince whose rule might be taken with a sword or with a knife. He was born in a manger in the backyard of Bethlehem. And Jesus showed us and he showed the world another way. No longer was heaven reserved for the spiritual elite. No longer should the poor go unfed. No longer should the persecuted be downtrodden. No longer should those who mourn continue to weep alone. No longer should the righteous be falsely accused. No longer. He put a line in that human history for us. And one of the stories to reinforce his way of thinking was this story of the widow's offering in Mark chapter 12. And it's already been read for us there. Jesus sat down opposite the place where the offerings were put and he just watched. I bet he did that a lot. I love people watching. I love going to crowds. I love going to, I don't like going to shopping centres actually. Bunnings is about the only shop I like going to. But when I do go to crowded situations, I watch people. And this is exactly what Jesus did. Opposite where the spiritual action was going on, he was just taking note and watching. And then he gave some commentary on what was going on. He noticed something nobody else noticed. This widow giving what she had, the widow's offering. Dr. Jacquin Braga, in an article entitled Out of Scarcity, Abundance, writes this: there are many reasons why Christianity does not make sense to me. For two of my five brothers, they're asking similar questions. One of whom has been a Christian but is not sure how to navigate that journey now, and one that has just paused Christianity, put Christianity on hold. This guy and a couple of my brothers asked, how can a righteous, all good, all powerful being allow the existence of suffering and evil? It's a question a lot of your neighbours and perhaps some of your family ask. How can a chosen nation, supposed to be the channel of spiritual blessing to all the other nations, that is engrossed in worship, that becomes engrossed in worshipping a golden statue shortly after being miraculously delivered from the most powerful nation of time? How could that happen? Or a creator king who was born as a helpless baby in a stable, literally in the middle of nowhere, destined to become the redeemer and savior of all? That's flipped everything. Or a divine kingdom supposed to change the world that is entrusted to 12 or 11 and then 12 again disciples, unimpressive, mostly uneducated men with all sorts of spiritual blindness. How can you entrust the kingdom's coming to this mob? Or an eternal being whose experience is death for the sake of creatures who do not want anything to do with him in the first place? And referring to the story of the widow who gave so little but means so much, this passage reminded him, that author, yet again, how upside down God's kingdom is when compared to the ways of the world. Everything about this widow screams of scarcity. Not enough to give. Not enough to matter. Not enough to make an impact. Not enough to be noticed. Not enough to be special or significant. And not enough to justify her own existence. And yet Jesus called his disciples to him. He said, have a look at what I've seen, guys. Come here. I've just been sitting here watching, the people watching. But look, truly I tell you that this poor woman has given more into the treasury than all the others. They gave out of their wealth. They gave out of their security. She gave out of her poverty. Years ago, I preached a message around the notion of what it meant to glorify God. Who's familiar with catechisms? Some of you will be. Put up your hand if you are, just a couple of you. What is a catechism? Well, a catechism is a way of learning where the teacher asks the pupil a question and the pupils give the answer. So a catechism, one of the most famous one is, what is the chief end of mankind? What is the chief end of man? And the answer the students would give back is, man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. And so this was a way of learning, to learn catechisms. What is the chief end of man? And you will all say, to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. So what truly gives us as people meaning, purpose, and a reason to live? To glorify God and to enjoy him forever. But what does it mean to glorify God? Well, the Bible tells us that God has a glory all of his own. In Isaiah 48:11, I will not yield my glory to another. God is glorious. So how can we glorify God? And it was, again, years ago, Pastor Leith Anderson, pastor and an author, he actually wrote the book Setting the Captives Free, he suggested what it was to glorify God. I was actually attending a conference and he was one of the key leaders, and he said, What is it to glorify God? Let me make it simple for you. It's to make God look good. And I love that definition. How do you glorify God? Make him look good to the world. Do you want your life to have meaning? Make God look good. Do you want your life to have purpose? Make God look good. Do you want your life to count for something? Make God look good. And in this story, this widow makes God look good. Why? Because of her great faith. The point Jesus is making is not orientated on the amounts which are given. This person gave a lot and this person gave a little. It's not about that, but the motivation behind the gift. It's not a sin to be wealthy. And so I'll state that again. It's not a sin to be rich. It's always about the motivation of the heart. It's always about what's underneath your giving and your attitudes. And so just like one is not godlier for being poor, however, before we draw on some simple principles of life from this passage, it's important to comment on the context. The passage is preceded by Mark chapter 12, verses 38 to 40. And so Jesus actually, if we had a longer reading, as he taught, Jesus said, "Watch out for the teachers of the law. They like to walk around in their flowing robes and be greeted with respect in the marketplace. And they have the most important seats in the synagogues and the places of honour at banquets. They devour widows' houses and for a show make lengthy prayers. These men will be punished most severely." That's just preceding the passage that we've read. They're pretty strong words, and Jesus never pulled any punches. He always was able to call a spade a spade. They devour widows' houses. Another commentary suggests the practice of devouring of houses is much more likely to refer to the scribes' habits of sponging off the hospitality of people and those of limited means. So you had the Sadducees, you had the spiritual elite, you had these people of power and influence sponging off poor people for their own benefit. And that's what Jesus was looking at. He was saying, here's somebody that's given all that she has, and here are these other people who do have stuff, and they have their flowing robes, and they have all their means about them, and yet they're still sponging off those that have little. The commentary goes on to suggest, although we do not have access to the details of the practice, it seems that this sense of the passage is that the devouring of widows' houses is a serious breach of trust and actually a true crime, much worse than merely sponging on hospitality. This is supported by the force of the word translated devour. So there in the Greek, this word devour suggests an action of consuming completely. They didn't just take advantage of people, they took advantage of all that they had. Not simply sponging, but it's fair to say that whoever or whatever the object of the devouring, it will be completely consumed as a result. In financial matters, a devoured victim would be left penniless. An interesting sort of comparison then, as we make Jesus' judgment of what was going on in the world to a woman that gave all that she had, that was left penniless. Look, disciples, look at what's going on here. Mark takes great care to emphasize the depth of this woman's poverty. This is a pronouncement story. Mark's concern is to create a sense of contrast between the widows and those that exploit widows. So here it's set up for us to see those that are exploiting and those that are exploited. Take a look at who Jesus is using as an example of spiritual discernment and worship. A penniless widow is more spiritual than the spiritual elite. An upside down, back of the front kingdom, a penniless widow is more spiritual than the spiritual elite. This unlikely model that we're supposed to emulate has three fundamental things going against her according to society. She's a woman, she's a widow, and she's poor. How could that teach us anything? That's what society would say. She's only a woman. She's only a widow. She's only poor. She doesn't have much. Now, why did I choose this passage for today? Well, some of you might think the same about yourself. Some of you might even think something of that about your church or some of the churches I go to visit. They're only small in number, 20 or 30 people, if that, meeting together. And I'm here to encourage us. Don't ever think poorly of yourself as a church or as an individual. Here in this story, society would say she's only a woman. Ah, she's only poor, she's only a widow. What would she have to offer? But both in Jesus' time as well as in ours, these traits that would encourage the elite to ignore or even despise the woman, her gender makes her inferior and voiceless, her marital status makes her helpless and needy, while her poverty makes her empty-handed and devoid of offering anything good. Perhaps this passage is not meant so much as praise for those who give everything, but a further condemnation of the rich and the powerful. The religious officials of the day, instead of helping the widows in need, were perfectly content to rob them of their own livelihood and inheritance. So even though they should have been, because they were positioned well to help, didn't in that way. It still actually happens today. Institutions that allow the CEOs and the staff to live a lavish lifestyle while the rest of society is exploited to keep these institutions running. Institutions which, in theory, should exist to help the poor, not consume what few resources they have. And we live in the same sort of world that Jesus came into 2,000 years ago. The actions of this destitute widow, and perhaps not being praised, but lamented. And it's worth noting, though, there at no point does Jesus explicitly praise the widow for what she's done. It's true that her donation is more than all the donations of the rich, but he doesn't say that she's a better person because of it. After all, her living has now been consumed by her offering to the temple. But in verse 40, he condemns the scribes for devouring widows' houses. Perhaps a modern day example might be some of the rich televangelists we used to have in the 80s and 90s and maybe the early 2000s that were actually caring not so much about the money that they got, just as long as they could build their empire and live an extravagant life. And so it happens even 2,000 years later. Here are these rich people getting all they can from those that mightn't have the means to give. So what can we learn from this passage? What can each of us learn? Well, there are several things that this story of the widow's mite teaches us. First, God sees what is often overlooked. I love that. And again, like I said, people watching or Jesus just watching there at the temple, God sees what is often overlooked. Maybe the way in which you helped somebody that nobody else saw, or that you did something, or that you gave something that nobody else sees. God sees what is often overlooked. The big gifts in the temple were truly, surely noticed by people. That's possibly what the disciples were watching. The rich people with their robes and the flashness, giving. Maybe that was a spectacle. But Jesus saw what no one else did. He saw the humble gift of this poor widow. This was the gift that Jesus thought worthy of comment and was the gift that the disciples needed to be aware of. The other gifts in the treasury that made a lot of noise, but the widow's mite was heard in heaven. When we were little, perhaps you might have been told that God sees everything. You know, when you were a little child or whatever, your parents might have told you that as well. But he does. God sees what we often overlook. I remember years ago when I was a child. Again, I've got five brothers, four of whom are still alive. Three of us are within a year and 10 days. So I have a twin brother who's also a pastor. And then I have another brother 1 year and 10 days younger. So Mum almost had two teenage boys and then three young toddlers. We were a hard bunch to keep control of. And at one stage, the three of us were playing outside of our house, and we had a small fence in front of our house about so high. And we used to love climbing up on that fence and then being as stiff as a board, falling to see who could remain sort of stiff for as long as they could as they were falling. And we would get up, do that, and then fall down, and get up, do that, fall down. Well, I got impatient with my younger brother and I just pushed him off the fence as he was halfway in the middle of this, and his head fell and cracked on the garden bed concrete surrounds. So there was blood gushing everywhere. We must have been 6 or 7 years of age. I was panicking now that I would get into a lot of trouble for what I just did, because I'd just pushed my younger brother. Well, he was screaming and I was trying to keep him as quiet as possible. He was screaming for mum and dad. Mum and dad came from whatever they were doing. They raced him off to the doctors to get stitches. And about an hour or 2 hours later, I was still panicking in my heart. I was going to have to face the consequences for what just happened. But there were no consequences. Mum and dad didn't discipline me. They didn't even comment on it. Ross didn't say anything, my younger brother. I thought I'd got away with this scot-free. And year after year, nothing was mentioned of this incident. Until about 10 or 12 years later, when we were 17 or 18, and family traditions, families have these little stories that gain a little bit of sort of notoriety, you know, and so we talked about the various scars that we had, and Ross would often say, oh, remember when I stayed as stiff as I could and I just fell onto the concrete and split my head open? Well, I'd just become a recent Christian. And so one family dinner when we were about 19 or 20, I actually fessed up. And I said, Ross, you didn't fall, I pushed you. And Mum, from the corner, said, I know, I saw you. She had kept quiet for all those years. She was inside. She saw what I'd done, and she just let me live with the guilt of that until I finally confessed. Well, God sees everything. Nothing for him goes unnoticed. God sees what we often overlook. God sees your service. God sees your heart. God knows the hours you put in to serve him. When nobody else takes note, God knows. Second, God's assessment is often different from ours. The widow's two mites added up to a penny, according to man's tabulation. But Jesus said she'd given more than anyone else on that day. How could this be when many rich people gave such large amounts? The difference is one of proportion. The rich were giving large sums, but still remained with their fortunes, and the widow put in everything that she had to live on. Here was a true sacrifice. The rich had not begun to give to her level of sacrifice. It's not about equal giving, it's about equal sacrifice for us as Christians. I remember years ago when our church, the church I was attending at that stage, this is some years ago, was going through a large renovation project and expansion. And the pastor at that time was encouraging people to consider selling things that they had accumulated. And that was often misinterpreted as well by other people. But suffice to say, he came up with that phrase that I remember. It's not about equal giving. It's about equal sacrifice. And thirdly, God commands giving in faith. That's what it's all about. Here was a woman in need of receiving charity, yet she had a heart to give. Even though the amount was negligible, she gave it in faith that God could use it. The widow's faith is also evident in the fact that she gave all of her last money. What was she going to live on for this coming week? Like the widow in the Old Testament that shared her last meal with Elijah, the widow in the temple gave away her last means of self-support. The point is whether or not we're acting in faith. The rich in this passage were being religious and superficial, and the widow was giving her whole heart and self to God, much like Mary Magdalene, who interrupted Jesus' meal by breaking an alabaster of perfume over his head. She was condemned by Judas for wasting a year's wages. And we read that in Matthew 25. The Bible teaches us there is something that pleases the heart of God, and it's all about faith. In Hebrews 11:6, it states, without it, you can't please God. The Bible also tells us that it's what the ancients were commended for, people like Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham. God was pleased with them, as he was with Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and Moses. God was even pleased with a prostitute named Rahab. And he could be pleased with you if you operate in faith. And Jesus rebuked his disciples for not having much of it. So it's not about how much faith you have. It might be a little faith, but in a great God. That's always what that comparison was. It's not about how much you give. It's not about how much you have. Is it in God? What makes God happy? Faith. William Booth, General William Booth, the founder of the Salvation Army, said, "Faith and works, they should travel side by side, step answering to step, like the legs of a man walking. First faith, then works, then faith again, then works, until they can scarcely distinguish which is one and which is the other." Martin Luther King Jr. said, "Faith is taking the first step even when you don't see the first staircase." So how can we sum up this little story today? First of all, God sees what we often overlook. And God's assessment is often different from ours. And God commends giving in faith. So how does that relate to you today? Or how does that relate to East Doncaster? Perhaps it is that you don't feel like you've got much to offer. Give it regardless, and give it in faith, and let's see what God does. Let's pray. Some of you might feel more like that widow than you do like a spiritual elite or a person of influence. Today we have something called influencers, if you can believe it. People on social media that influence other people. Influencers. Is it those that God is looking to? Does it matter how many clicks or likes we have on our own social media? Or is it more about giving in faith? Perhaps the little that you might have to offer. And in a roundabout sort of way, I want to encourage you today that if this church continues to operate in faith, if you as individuals continue to take steps of faith, it doesn't matter how much you might have, whether that's your gifts or talents or resources or wealth, whatever it is. It doesn't matter how little you might feel like you have to offer. God can do great things through it. And so I want to encourage you to step out again and again and again and again in faith. Give that which you mightn't be able to give, but trust in God. Come, Holy Spirit. I pray for East Doncaster Baptist Church. I pray, Lord, for its wonderful heritage and history. And Lord, I pray for its future. That, Lord, this would be a church known for giving in faith. Individuals would be known for giving in faith. And Lord, you might do great things amongst us. In Jesus' name.